Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you listening this morning. In this part of Focus, we will be talking generally about American politics, and specifically, we'll be looking at this question. Why is it that socialism has never really taken root here in the United States? Socialist parties, parties with various kinds of names, have been major forces in every democratic country in the world, with the exception of the United States. We will explore this question this morning with our guest, Seymour Martin Lipset. He is the co-author of a book that explores this territory. The title of the book is It Didn't Happen Here, Why Socialism Failed in the United States. It is published by W.W. Norton. Our guest, Seymour Martin Lipset, is professor of public policy at George Mason University, a fellow of the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. If you're interested in American politics, by the way, you might look at another book that he's written titled American Exceptionalism, A Double-Edged Sword, which is also published by Norton and is now available in paperback. His co-author on this book, by the way, is Gary Marks, who teaches political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. As we talk this morning with Seymour Martin Lipset, questions are welcome. Questions, comments certainly are welcome. We just ask one thing of callers, and that is to try to be brief in your comments so that we can keep things moving along and accommodate as many different callers as possible. Do remember that you're sharing the space with others, and try and be generous with them as we are with you. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. If you match the numbers with letters on the phone, you get WILL. So that's another way to think about it. It's 333-WILL. And toll-free, 800-222-WILO. Professor Lipset, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us. You say early on in the book that perhaps one of the challenges in dealing with this question is not that there are too few answers, but that there are too many, or at least over time, as people have thought about this, they've offered many different explanations. Do you? And we could talk about these things in detail, but I wonder if, as a general point, you would say that there is no one answer to this question, why is it that socialism failed in the United States?
Well, that's quite true. I mean, as I argue, there are a lot of different factors in American society, social structure, economy, history, that have operated against it. But I would argue and suggest that there's one which I think is the most important, and that is a culture, or an aspect of the culture, that the United States as a nation, coming out of its history and its religious tradition, is by far the most anti-state or anti-statist country in the world. Americans have been reared to distrust the state in ways that Europeans and Canadians have not. And that this has, therefore, made it extremely difficult for the socialists. Not impossible, because socialists have made headway in places in the U.S. and might have done it under other conditions. But this anti-state tradition goes back to the Revolution. We were the most first successful revolution for democracy and independence. And that revolution had an ideology which was codified in the Declaration of Independence. And Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the Declaration, once said, that government is best which governs least. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a conclusion that one of the founding fathers came to, in which they set for the country. We also, if I can add another factor, we have a unique religion, an exceptional religion, to use Tocqueville's terms about the United States being exceptional. Namely, the majority of Christians in this country are Protestants, what are known as Protestant sectarians. That is Methodists, Baptists, Quakers, and the myriad of hundreds of other religions, Christian religions. And these differ substantially from what is the dominant religion in Europe and in Canada, where they were so-called, and the religious writers codify as the church religions. The churches are state-related institutions, the Anglicans, the Catholics, the Lutherans, the Orthodox, which are hierarchical institutions. They have bishops and archbishops, and which also in Europe and to some extent in Canada have been state-supported and state-related, and where the hierarchy sets down, and did more in the past perhaps than the present, a dogma and explains things for their parishioners. The American Protestantism has not only doesn't have hierarchs, but also is congregational, which means that the parishioners control the denominations and hire their pastors or their priests, and in effect are in a position to tell them what to do. And one of the things that is felt or believed in most of the Protestant sects is that the individual should read the Bible and come to their own conclusions as to what is right and wrong, should interpret it on their own, not the way the Pope or the Bishop tells them to do. And that made for individualism and also activism and the whole plethora of voluntary associations, which so impressed Tocqueville.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about some of the other factors that you explore in the book. The first thing that you talk about is the American party system and the fact that, as people know, American politics is dominated by two parties, and it has been very difficult for third parties to make any dent in this system. And not just this is not something just applying to socialists, but other third parties as well. And some people have argued that perhaps it's not really so much a problem with socialism per se, but that third parties simply, the two parties dominate the system to such an extent that make it so difficult for third parties that no third party is likely to make any sort of significant inroad into American politics.
Well, that's very true, and of course it's pertinent to the election this year, where Ralph Nader, Pat Buchanan, and others are, you know, running as third or fourth party candidates. And as you say, no third party, including, by the way, the Republicans, who are often cited as a successful one, have been able to move from minor party status to becoming a major party. The reason the Republicans are not an exception is when the Republicans were created, one of the two parties, namely the Whig Party, had broken up. And the Republican Party was largely the Whig Party outside the South, renamed and including some other elements, so that the Republicans never moved from being a minor party to being a major party. And one of the factors, perhaps the most important factor that undermines third parties, is the fact that we elect one person to be the head of government. We don't have parliaments, where in Europe and in Canada, parliaments, which are elected in single-member districts or by proportional representation, pick or support the prime minister and the cabinet. The public never votes for them. You only vote for a member of parliament or for a party list. And in that context, it's much easier to support to have different parties in different parts of the country or to get your vote counted by proportional representation. Here, you're faced with the dilemma which exists this year. You know, you have two people running, Bush and Gore. A lot of people don't like either of them, but they have a lesser evil choice. The people who would like to see Nader win, almost all of them prefer Gore to Bush. The people who favor Buchanan, I think many of them prefer Bush to Gore. And the pressure comes on candidates to vote for, to give up, by the time election day, to give up their support of a third party on the grounds that that will help elect the person they most dislike. But this has hurt the Socialist Party, but it also hurt various other third parties. And it's interesting to note, in terms of the question of the possible development of socialism, that we have had a number of third parties in this country, which in single elections, rarely two of them, have gotten a lot of votes. Senator La Follette, running in 1924, got, I think, 17%. Perot in 1992 got 19%. John Anderson got about 8%. George Wallace got 12%. So that Americans have been willing to vote for a third party when they're discontented, but in much larger numbers than they've ever voted for the socialists. The biggest vote the socialists got was in 1912 when Eugene Debs got 6%. The most they got in any other election was 2. So that, you know, there's an element of disdain or refusal to support the socialists, which goes beyond the pressures against third parties.
Perhaps at this point I should introduce again our guest for this hour, of Focus 580. We're talking with Seymour Martin Lipset. He is professor of public policy at George Mason University. If you'd like to read more on this subject, you should look for a book that he co-authored, which is titled It Didn't Happen Here, Why Socialism Failed in the United States. It's published by W.W. Norton and is out now. It came out in July, so should be in the bookstore if you'd like to look at it, possibly in the library. Also, of course, questions and comments are welcome if you'd like to call in. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Another factor that you and your co-author write about in the book is the dislocation or the failure to connect between socialists on a political level and organized labor. And it does seem curious that while here we have in socialist the Socialist Party, we have a major party that is oriented toward the working class that was completely unconnected, almost completely unconnected from the mainstream of organized labor in this country. Why is that the case, that the two never really came together?
Well, this is, of course, quite true. And in the other countries, all of the countries, where you've had relatively large socialist or labor parties, the trade union movement is either a major force inside them, helped found them, or support them. In this country, the socialists before World War I, when they had a fair amount of strength, tried very hard to get the support of the trade unions, but failed. And the questions of why the trade unions wouldn't support the socialists are many, but they go back to the larger thing. For one thing, trade unions in this country, at least until the 30s, were anti-state. You know, the American Federation of Labor, which some people have described as the conservative labor movement compared, say, to the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, who was Wobbly's revolutionary movement. The American Federation of Labor was what's known in all the discussions of labor, a syndicalist. They believed in workers' power, but not state power. Their founding president and president for 40 years, Samuel Gompers, once when asked what his politics were, said three-quarters of an anarchist. And the AFL was opposed in large measure to the welfare state. They believed that the workers should try to get things on their own through their own institutions. And then we had a revolutionary labor movement that was much weaker, the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, but they were not socialists. They were anarchists. They were anarcho-syndicalists. So that the American labor movement absorbed or maintained the same degree or considerable degree of anti-statism that other groups in the society do or have. In fact, we've had a kind of right-wing anti-state, or conservative anti-statism, if you will, has in recent years been organized through the Republican Party. But you had left anti-statism through the labor movement. Now, this changed during the 1930s with Roosevelt and the New Deal and the Great Depression, when the CIO, Congress of Industrial Organizations, which later merged with the AFL, did support a lot of welfare state measures, and Roosevelt in turn and the Democrats supported them, so that there was a much more involvement of unions in politics from the 30s on, but it wasn't socialist politics, it was Democratic Party politics. For one thing, you know, they saw themselves getting so much support from Roosevelt and so much help for things that poorer people needed, that even the socialists among them felt that one had to support Roosevelt against the Democrats, that one shouldn't try to push a third party that might help defeat him.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? And also other folks who are listening are welcome. Their questions, comments are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free. Anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We have our first caller in Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I think that Professor Lipset is saying some very important things about why socialists and also third parties in general have not taken root. But I think he's missing in a very important dimension, and that's the political dimension, and more specifically, repression. That is to say that if we went back to, let's say, Bellamy's book, Looking Backward, which was a socialist text published at the turn of the century, just before the 20th century, One year, it outsold all books except for the Bible. Now, something happened in the early 20th century, and perhaps one of the most important things that happened in the early 20th century was World War I, when the American Socialists opposed it. And what Professor Lipset didn't say, but is the case, is that when the socialist candidate, Eugene Debs, got almost 1 million votes in the United States, he did so while he was sitting in a prison cell for the opposition to World War I. Now, we had alien sedition laws, we had the Palmer raids, we had a concerted effort by the U.S. government to destroy the Socialist Party. And that continued. The CIO, which was mentioned, had a very large contingent of socialists within it. And then you got the Taft-Hartley Law, which cleared the radicals, socialists and communist radicals, who were suspected, out of that union. And then after World War I, in addition, you had McCarthyism, which made it very difficult for anybody anywhere on the left to operate. I would urge your readers and Professor Lipset to read a very good book published by someone who is a student at the U of I, and U of I Press is reissuing it this year or next, called Repression in America by Robert Justin Goldstein. That's a very essential part of this story. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate the call, and I know that, Professor Lipset, this is a question that you deal with in the book. Perhaps you'd like to respond to the comments of the caller.
Yes, of course. You know, one of the problems, even if we have close to an hour, is you obviously can't present everything that's in a book or whatever. And there is a chapter, I'd urge the listener to read the book, there is a chapter in the book on repression. Now, and I mention, I think, most of the things which he discusses, but I come to very different conclusions about it. One reason is that the book itself is set in the comparative context. To answer the question of why no socialism in America or any other broad question, you have to do it by looking at other countries. You know, this is something all my work is exemplified. Tocqueville, who wrote the great book on America, never wrote a word about America without thinking about France. And one has to see, you know, how different behavior patterns in this country correspond to other countries. Now, one of the things about it is that repression was much greater in various European countries than it was in the United States. And the effect of repression of both the trade union movement and the socialist movements in many of these countries was to make them stronger. Persecution would lead to a lot of people who believed in civil liberties or freedom or whatnot to support the socialists. In the late 19th century, the Germans passed the so-called anti-socialist laws, which were in effect for over 10 years, and which outlawed the Socialist Party. They couldn't run for office, the Social Democratic Party. They were repealed because the government recognized that the Social Democrats as an underground organization or an illegal organization were getting stronger. Lenin, in discussing why no socialism in the United States, and, you know, his party did under the Tsarist regime, which was totally repressive, not only of the Bolsheviks, but of every other opposition tendency. And the Bolsheviks grew under Tsarist repression. Well, Lenin wrote explicitly that one of the problems of the socialists in the United States was that the United States was not overly democratic, but was so democratic, and that the socialists in Europe had gained strength by fighting for civil liberties and for democratic rights and the right to vote, and that fighting for that is a much easier thing to do to explain to people than to fight for socialism, which is a very abstract thing. And he thought, you know, the United States, you got the ballot without a big fight for it. And in fact, somebody once called it the free gift of the ballot in the U.S. Workers, before they existed as an organized group, already had the right to vote, whereas in Europe they had to fight for the right to vote. Well, there was a French revolutionary in the late 19th century named Blanqui, who enunciated a theory that what revolutionary movements had to do was to force authority to be repressive. That unless authority was repressive, you couldn't organize, you couldn't build a mass movement. That was sort of Lenin's argument on a more general scale. Martin Luther King said they had to, you know, that demonstrations had to result in police suppression. Otherwise, and that was a way to get mass support. And so the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, had a conscious policy of what they called them filling the jails. in order to get support. Eugene Debs was arrested and put in jail, and he hadn't served in jail for a few years. But what the caller may not know is that Debs was very upset that they hadn't arrested him earlier, and kept complaining. And he made a speech in Canton, Ohio, which led to his arrest, which was a very aggressive or anti-war revolutionary speech. And at the end of the speech, he turned to some friend of his and says, "Well, I guess now they'll have to arrest me." He was desirous of becoming a martyr around whom one could rally. The other aspect of repression in the United States is the most severe repression has been wartime repression, as the caller mentioned, during World War I. World War II, there wasn't, because we were attacked by the Japanese, there wasn't much opposition to the war. The Korean War, you know, McCarthyism, the dates of McCarthyism are 1950 to 1954. McCarthy's first speech was in 50. He was finished by 1954. Now, if he knows anything about history, you would know that 1950 to 1954 are the years of the Korean War. As we were at war with a communist government, the North Koreans, and with China, and in that period, we engaged in repressive activities against people whom we thought were supporting the enemy, supporting the other side. Now, much of the latter-day repression was dictated at the communists. And one of the things which happened during the McCarthy period, which was unfortunate beyond what McCarthy himself and others did, was that the communists never defended civil liberties, never defended their right to be communists. Every left-wing group in the United States that suffered persecution, the socialists, the anarchists, the Trotskyists, the Wobblies, all of them said, "We are socialists, we are anarchists, we are Wobblies, we are Trotskyists, we're proud of it, we have a right to be. This is the American tradition." The communists never said that. They either, first, they lied, they committed perjury, and the government indicted them for perjury, not for being communists, or later on, they used the Fifth Amendment. No one said, "I'm a communist, and therefore I can be a communist." What they said was that the government was persecuting the people it was persecuting because they were liberals, or defenders of civil liberties or civil rights, never as communists, and hence there was no fight for civil liberties during the Korean War. There was no fight against McCarthy. It became a detective game. Was X a communist or not, and so on. And of course, many of them were, even though they denied it. I'm not saying that people who weren't communists didn't feel hemmed in or persecuted during McCarthyism. But the bulk of the people they got after, both the government and McCarthy himself, were communists. Now, I don't think communists should have been, their rights should have been suppressed. But the communists themselves never said that. They never defended these rights. The Taft-Hartley Act outlawed communists holding union office, not radicals, not socialists. And, of course, many socialists stopped being socialists, not because they were being persecuted, but because they wanted to support Franklin Roosevelt. Norman Thomas, who was the six-time candidate of the Socialist Party for presidency, once said, and I think we quote him in the book, that he has to say that he never really faced any persecution, that the socialists had always had in his day, which was 1928 to the 50s, always were able to operate. He could make speeches wherever he wanted. People could come to the meetings. People didn't feel intimidated by this, and hence he didn't feel that repression hurt the socialists or the Socialist Party.
I'm going to jump in here, and I hope the caller will forgive me. He probably would like to follow up, but we're already at the midpoint. I have somebody else I'd like to include. Well, I tell you, on this program, we have for a long time encouraged and appreciated thorough treatment of subjects, so I don't think you have any need to apologize.
Okay. Thank you.
Our guest this morning, Seymour Martin Lipset, professor of public policy, George Mason University. If you'd like to read more on the subject, you can certainly look at the book that he has co-authored, came out this summer, and is in bookstores. It's titled "It Didn't Happen Here," the subtitle, "Why Socialism Failed in the United States." Our guest is professor of public policy at George Mason University, fellow of the Hoover Institution at Stanford, also the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. And we have another caller here, someone from Paris, somebody on a car phone here, line two.
Good morning.
Yes.
My father was active politically in the late 20s through the early 50s. His comment to me has been, gee, I don't know about this, but it seems to me that everything that was in the socialist platforms for president has now been enacted into law and is part of our current society. How would you deal with that comment?
Well, that's not everything, but it's partially true. Even though we've had this anti-statist tradition, as a result of the Great Depression, when 25% were unemployed and so on, and pressures which Roosevelt pressed, we've got a lot of state efforts, government efforts passed by Congress to alleviate the plight of the poor and the unemployed and so forth, Social Security, unemployment insurance, the Wagner Act, which helped foster trade unions and the like. Well, these and many other measures were things which socialists wanted, but these weren't socialism. And they didn't go as far as measures, welfare state measures, went in most European countries or in Canada. For example, we don't have a government medical plan. Every other Western country, including or especially the Canadians, do. We don't have some family allowances, which other countries do. We've never had much government ownership, which many other countries have had. They're now getting rid of it. But socialism, meaning a country with, the definitions of socialism vary with the socialists, and there's no one that you have to say is the right one. But basically what it has meant, I think, is a much greater role for the state in the economy, in planning the economy and owning the economy, in providing safety nets for various people. And while we've moved in the direction of this thing, these measures, we never went very far, and we didn't go very far as compared, as I say, to the European countries and to the Canadians. Now, one of the interesting things that's happened in the last few years, and in the last chapter of the book, where we call it the end of political exceptionalism, is that the European socialists have given up socialism. You know, if you say every other country had a socialist party except the United States, you can now say that no country has a socialist party. They all have parties, well, many of them have parties which call themselves socialists, or Labour Party, as in Britain, or the New Democrats, as in Canada. But all of these parties have given up the advocacy of a fully planned government ownership society. They've moved back to to something more resembling the program of the Democratic Party in this country, and hence the a lot of the European social democratic parties have sold off much of the government industry. The British did, the Germans are doing it, and the like. They've also cut taxes. Many of the programs which here are pushed by the Republicans, reducing the corporate tax, the estate tax, personal income taxes for the more well-to-do, have been done in Europe by socialist parties, by the British Labour Party, by the German Social Democrats, now by the French Socialists, all of whom have seemingly come to the conclusion that state operations in the economy are dysfunctional, that the market is the best way to increase productivity and increase the standard of living of the population.
Let me pose a question that you take up later in the book, and it is somewhat speculative, but the question being, how do you think that the United States and American politics might today be different if socialists had been more successful and had gained a foothold in this country?
Well, I think the most obvious way, is sort of the inverse of what I've been saying, namely, that we'd have much more of a welfare state, we'd have, socialized government medicine, we'd have a broader safety net, we'd probably have more government ownership and of major industries, we'd have, different programs to better the situation of the less privileged, of the poor in the country, and we'd have more support, conversely, depending on how it might have come about. Government support for trade unions, or rather stronger trade unions, which would support the Socialist Party. Right now, the only 14% of the employed American labor force belongs to trade unions. Now, this is an extremely low figure compared to other countries. The Canadians, that's 38%. the largest in Scandinavia, I think in Sweden it's over 90%. It's 40 to 50% in countries like Britain and Germany. So that, you know, all of these would have made a big difference. And, of course, you have this issue of, you know, the attitudes towards the state. These would have had to be changed more fundamentally than they ever had. If I can make an interesting and in some ways one might say amusing point about statism, you know, I've made these references to Canada, and actually I've been very interested in Canada as a comparative case to the United States, because we forget that two countries came out of the American Revolution. The United States was the part of British North America where the revolution succeeded, and Canada was the part of British North America where the revolution failed, which retained the monarchy, which developed parliamentary forms as another post-monarchical countries and the like, and which retained a more positive attitude towards the state. You know, positive attitudes to the state are not just something fostered by left-wing groups. They also, in Europe and in Canada, have been fostered by the right. Conservatism in Europe meant something very different from what we call conservatism in this country. European conservatives were in favor of a strong, monarchical, noblesse oblige state. The welfare state, which, you know, in which the upper class accepted responsibility, and the state did, for the position of the lower, problems of the lower classes, not to push for equality, but to have a kind of noblesse oblige. The welfare, you know, the Disraeli and Bismarck were associated with the beginnings of the welfare state in Germany and Britain, and both of these men were conservatives, so that the doctrine of the conservatives was a kind of noblesse oblige one. But then the Social Democrats came along, and they were also for stronger statism from the left. In the United States, we never had these. We didn't know our so-called conservatives, who are really, you know, what the Europeans used to call liberal, are anti-state. And the left, the Democrats, are less anti-state than the Republicans, but much less statist than European socialists, social democrats, communists used to be. So you have a very different context in these two parts of the world. Now, so that to have gotten the socialist strength here, you would have had to have, or we would have had to have, changes in these attitudes. But the fact that the revolution succeeded meant anti-statism was dominant here. In Canada, where the revolution failed, statism was much stronger. And ironically, and then statism in Canada and in Europe, which was fostered by conservatives, also helped develop strong social democratic movements, because you've got a right-wing statism and a left-wing statism. Here we've had a right-wing anti-statism and to some extent a left-wing anti-statism, as you did with the labor movement. Now, if we had lost the revolution, then, you know, we would have been Canada. That is, the kind of political institutions we would have had and values would have been similar to Canada. And ironically, if that had happened, we'd have more stronger socialist movements. So you can say the American Revolution, which was in a sense a revolution from the left over historical terms, helped to foster, you know, the defeat of the left, and at least the socialist left in later years.
Well, let us talk with some other callers. Let's talk with someone again in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, very interesting discussion. It's really too much to absorb all at once. But
read the book.
Yeah. I was just wondering if you saw any kind of two questions, and then I'll hang up. If you saw any kind of leftover influence of the Civil War, if there was kind of a North-South, you know, causality here. And the other question was, I was wondering if you thought that there was anything peculiar about our academia that, or did they ever have a role in that they either missed or, you know, are playing badly or whatever, and I'll hang up. Thank you.
All right.
Well, thank you. Well, in the Civil War, come back to it, but you know what you bring up, or implicitly bring up, which I discuss, or we discuss in the book, is the influence of racism and of immigration on the prospects for socialism. And these had a negative thing, you know, as various people, including Karl Marx and Engels and so on, noted. The American working class was divided ethnically and racially. And, you know, there was a lot of conflict, you know, workers who were anti-black or who fought among each other in racial terms and had racial identities rather than class identities. Now, that was all a consequence, both part of slavery and part of the fact that we imported or, you know, people from all over the world who had had these different traditions. But the Civil War itself, other than, you know, I mean, resulted in freeing the slaves and so on, I don't think can be attributed to having a dynamic effect. One of the ironies, which is in a way hard to understand, is that before World War I, which is the period in which the Socialist Party was strongest, it had a fair amount of strength in parts of the South. The strongest state of the Socialists, where they got 16% of the vote, was Oklahoma, which had not been a territory in the Confederacy, but was, you know, in a sense, Southern. In Texas, I think, if I remember correctly, the Socialists got about 8%. And now blacks couldn't vote in the South. It was just whites and white workers. And that, in a sense, the fact that blacks were outside the polity made it easier, I think, to organize among the whites. Huey Long, who you may remember, was a populist, was autocratic, and some people call him a fascist, some people call him left-wing populist. But he talked about making every man a king. He attacked the rich. He was operated, you know, in the 1920s and 30s. Well, Huey Long came from a county in northern Louisiana, where the Populist Party, which was a third party, was strong, where the Socialists were strong. And that county, which produced Huey Long, was a county with a populist and socialist tradition, and it was in the South. Though I don't know how many blacks it had, so that it's hard to sort of, you know, attribute something directly to the Civil War. And I've never thought of it as a factor one way or the other that one might discuss in this context. With regard to academia, academia, as you probably know, has been on the left. Politically, certainly since the 20s and 30s. I think it goes back further than that. I found a study, I've done a fair amount of research on the politics of academia and looking for both I collected my own data and others. There was a study actually before World War I not on attitudes to politics, but attitudes to religion, which found that academics were much more likely to be atheists and irreligious than were the general public. And I would deduce from that they were also more likely to be liberal to radical in their politics. But, you know, studies done as well as just observation, certainly since World War II or before World War II, indicate, you know, a fair degree of leftism, including support for socialist positions among academics. This has been particularly true among social scientists, economists apart, and among humanists, and remains true up to the present. In fact, it's curiously even more true here than it is. I think, I don't really have hard data on this, than it is abroad. Well, one could go on this question of the issues of politics of academia, but again, that would take us afield, even though it's an issue which I've written a fair amount about. In fact, I think I have a chapter on it, not in the book on Why No Socialism, but in the American Exceptionalism book.
Hmm. Well, let's continue. Let's go to Terre Haute, Indiana, for another caller. This is line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
From the hometown of Eugene Debs. I'd recommend anybody to visit his home as a museum now near the university. My comment is that it seems that the most Marxist legislation ever to pass Congress is Social Security, and it's also the most sacred cow that nobody running for Congress would ever come out against it. And I just wonder if you'd talk about that irrational phenomenon, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Well, you're, of course, quite right. And, you know, it's been true generally that beyond Social Security, that government programs to help old people, retired people, and so on, have had more support than for any other population, because not only do we have Social Security, we have Medicare, and now we're getting proposals to expand the range of Medicare. And Medicare is, you know, is a particularly costly item because the bulk of medical expenses go for older people, and I think I've read that even for the last 6 months of life. So, but now Social Security, which was enacted in the 1930s and was pressed particularly by President Roosevelt, was, as you say, a very important measure. But you know this, and it's now one being debated in one way or the other, and questions raised about the fund running dry and all this kind of thing. If I may make a comment, which is not relevant to the issue of the socialists or socialists, but to the Social Security debate today, I think there's a lot of nonsense or silliness in that debate, because every country in the world, in the developed countries, has an old age pension plan in which older people are given support by the government. And the names of these plans vary in the different countries, and the way they get their money varies in some sense. But the notion that somehow that our gifts or our old age system is dependent on something called the Social Security Fund and whether it's got enough money in it is, I think, is ridiculous. Because if for some reason the Social Security Fund should take in less than they're supposed to pay out, the government will pay it. The federal budget will pay it. This is what it's basically a commitment by the federal government. And we have a mechanism for paying it through what we call Social Security. And that was set up as an insurance system during the 30s as a way of getting people who disdain the idea of taking government money to accept Social Security. When Social Security, by calling it an insurance plan, you got people to say, and they were told by President Roosevelt and others, that this was your money, that you weren't taking a government handout, that this isn't welfare or relief, but you're just getting paid back on an insurance system. And what they did was to get various millionaires as well as Hollywood stars to come down and apply for their Social Security in order to demonstrate that, you know, rich or poor, you got Social Security because people didn't want to get a handout. But you know, we came around, given the Depression and the plight of the aged, to adopt this program, which, as was mentioned earlier, you know, socialists called for, but so did other people. In fact, Disraeli and Bismarck, who I mentioned before, introduced the first old-age pension systems back in the late 19th century. One reason that 65 became the year that you were supposed to retire, Bismarck set this. And at the time, not many people lived to be 65 or beyond it. So by setting up 65, he presumably knew that the pressure to pay out wouldn't be that great. Of course, now most people live beyond 65 and hence are entitled to get Social Security or old age pensions.
You know, the caller certainly points to Social Security, I think, as being the one big state program that has always enjoyed wide popular support. I think, in fact, once you start getting people thinking about it in those terms, they will find that as much as they might initially tell you that they're against big government, they would find other programs that they would favor, particularly those that benefited them personally. One area recently where there seems to be some willingness of some Americans to think of stated solutions to a problem is the issue of health care and the fact that there are a lot of people who don't have it. You know, given the fact that there is some support for that, I wonder to what extent it's possible that Americans today might be slightly more receptive to statist solutions to big problems, and that perhaps some of the factors that have contributed to lack of socialism might be moderating somewhat.
Well, I think you're right about medical care, health care, that there's been an increased support for it. And, you know, when the Clinton health plan was proposed in 1993, 1994, Hillary being in charge of it and so on, it got a lot of support. In fact, I think much of it could have been secured because the Republicans in the first year or so actually accepted a big chunk of what was proposed, close to, I think, to two-thirds of it. But the Democrats insisted on 100% or nothing, and they ended up getting nothing. But they could have gotten a great deal. And, you know, even Senator Dole, who was majority leader of the Senate, the Republicans, was going along with much of the bill. And I think the idea that people are entitled to get support, that health should be more equally distributed, is one which, as you say, does get widespread support. But it isn't part of a general approval or greater approval of statism, because we've moved back in the area of regulation, for example. Regulatory policies are much weaker. We've moved back, I think, in the area of wanting government to be directly involved in the economy. And I think anti-statist things, you know, the Republican Party, during and after Roosevelt, accepted much of the New Deal. They opposed it first, but then they went around and accepted it. But then in more recent years, they turned very anti-statist and much more than they used to be. So that now you can say they're a libertarian party. And the Democrats, on the other hand, have also given up much of the advocacy of increased statism, you know, the health area apart. There is, by the way, an interesting strategy. You know, the first sort of extension, widespread extension of state intervention came with the idea of support for the old people, Social Security, Medicare, and so forth. And now there's been a strategy since the health care bill of focusing on the young, of saying, let's give medical care, government medical supportive care to young people. And this is sort of if that gets enacted, and I think it will eventually, you'll have a situation where, say, people under 20 or what, 18, whatever it is, gets health care, and people over 60 or 65 get health care. And then the 20 to 60 group is out of that pattern. So then the pressure will be to sort of extend the age thing down and extend the youth thing up. And I think and the youth health care for the young and for the old will really not cover most people, maybe it would, but it will cover a very large proportion of the possible expenditures for health care. And that sort of strategy of the old and the young and then creeping into the center, the middle, is probably the way in which the expansion of health care will go.
We have a couple of minutes left. I want to try and squeeze one more caller here. Champagne, line two. Hello.
Yes, I recently read a book by Linda Gordon about the history of efforts to secure contraception in the United States and in Europe. And it talks about how if women's movements in the United States had been able to ally themselves with a stronger socialist party, they may have been able to secure more contraceptive information for women. I was wondering if you could just sort of speak about what you know about women and women's movements with respect to the Socialist Party. And I'm
okay. Well, unfortunately, I can only give you about a minute, but please go ahead.
I think the general thrust of the question is true, but the Socialists didn't, when they were in their heyday, didn't spend much time on the problem of women. In fact, there was a kind of general attitude among Socialists here and abroad that women should get equality and they would get it under Socialism, but the people who really needed help were the workers, so they didn't focus much on women.
Well, I'm sorry to force you to make such an abbreviated answer, but we are, in fact, at the end of the time, and we'll have to stop. Professor Lipson, we do want to say thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed this.
Our guest, Seymour Martin Lipset, he's professor of public policy, George Mason University. If you'd like to read the book we've mentioned, which he co-authored with Gary Marks from University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, the title, It Didn't Happen Here, Why Socialism Failed in the United States, published by W.W. Norton.